to the Mug Meeting Summaries Podcast. Our October 12th meeting featured a presentation called The Wireless Neighborhood, presented by the tag team of Kevin McGregor and Kelly LaVeille. Kevin McGregor and Kelly LaVeille are neighbors, pretty much. Not right next door, but they are within the same block of each other.
You'll have a really good sense of that by the end of the presentation.
And so this is kind of a real-world project that they've undertaken over the past few months or
years.
More than a year. And yeah, so they are going to present their results of their experiments. So, Kevin, Kelly.
Yeah, okay, I'll start it off. I think it was actually about 3 years ago that we got hooked up and decided that we would set up a backup system. I think I've been coming to these meetings for about 5 years, maybe six, and it was only after the first three, I suppose I moved once in between, but that I realized that Kevin lived about two doors away from me and we've been driving separately. Anyway, so myself and Kevin and another neighbor of ours, his name's Wes, his house will be featured in many of the pictures you'll see. Once we discovered we were all in the field of IT, decided we would set up off-site backup for each other. So our original setup was I had a box, just an old PC, over at Kevin's place. Kevin had one at Wes's place, and Wes had one at my place. And then we'd all run our sync to copy our stuff over to each other's house. And that worked great. It was simple. But there were limitations. Primarily for me, anyways, would be the upload bandwidth. Depending on what files you're going to copy up, I used to get, like, but at start, I was with MPS, so you get, 300 and some K up, and you're copying four ISOs of whatever. You sometimes would run into problems where, not only that, where it would be uploading for a long time, but it would also, I realized, if you saturate your upload speed with MPS, it kills your download speed, too. So we looked for an alternative means of connecting our houses together, essentially. And that was sort of the birth of this project. We wanted to keep it on the cheap as much as possible, but learn some stuff along the way, too. So if you don't mind, I'm going to sit and step you through. So our intention in setting this up was to continue our off-site backup system, to be able to add to that a shared media system where if we have files of our favorite distros that we wanted to share with each other, we could put it all there into a system that we could all browse, combine all our distros together.
Right.
And also, just for the nerdy fun of it, all the antennas and the routers and so on, and getting to learn a little bit about that. That was all put together. Our presentation won't include any demos. It's largely a whole bunch of pictures. It's to show you the implementation, what we did, and a little bit of what choices we made along the way, what worked and what didn't. So next, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin.
Oh, you're going to do the slide advance for me? Okay.
If you like.
We had, of course, a number of options once we decided to go the wireless route, but we didn't spend too much time on that because of various reasons. First of all, cost. We wanted something that was fairly popular and low-priced and still fairly functional, and since we were going to not go with the standard antennas, we wanted to make sure that the antennas were removable with a standard connector that we could use to put something else on. And we wanted something that maybe provided us with some features that weren't available with the stock firmware, so it had to be supported by the various alternate firmware distributions that we could use. Then once we decided that, we said, okay, well, probably the easiest thing that fits the bill was the Linksys WRT54G. And, of course, at that time, it turned out that they had switched over the firmware, Linksys had, rather, switched the firmware to VxWorks instead of using Linux as a version 5 of the router. So, of course, there were some hobbyists who were up in arms about that. So they said, okay, we'll produce the L one, which is L for Linux. So the difference between them being that they actually could cut costs even more with the VxWorks OS, which meant that they could use only 2 meg of ROM and 8 meg of RAM, whereas all the other versions of the Linksys had 4 meg of ROM and 16 meg of RAM. Not all versions, but the ones that we were looking at. So we went and bought a few of these, and they're, I think, only about, how much were they?
I think I didn't keep the bill, but I think we got them for $38 each.
That seems a bit low to me, but...
Yeah, it was right around 40, 38 something.
Okay. Then we had to figure out how to find an antenna, and where are our notes? That's the next page? Oh, okay.
It'd be easier if you say.
No, I think I'll just sort of skip ahead. Go to the next one. I'll talk about the rationale for and the issues around antenna selection soon. this is like the ultimate robo WRT 54G. It's got a Panasonic camera on the front here, and 54G, and it's a radio controlled thing, and you can actually steer it with wireless from a laptop. We haven't actually done this.
Actually, it probably is real.
Yeah, the link is in the link to that picture in the explanation.
Yeah, we do have a
it's
link
in the index in
later,
there, so
you can find out
for yourself.
And this is your slide.
Yep. So the next sort of significant part is looking at the software, and as Kevin mentioned, the stock firmware for the Linksys routers didn't do what we needed it to do.
Wanted it to do, sure.
Most specifically, the feature that was missing was the client wireless. And what that is allowing a router to connect to another router or wireless access point as a client. So you can establish a network between them. I think that some of the newer versions of this device or some of the Linksys firmware, I've seen some 3COM, I think it was 3COM, like consumer routers that would include that kind of stuff now.
I like 800s too as well.
Okay. But in any case, it was more fun to play with the alternate firmware anyway. So the two big ones that were sort of in consideration were the DDWRT and the OpenWRT. And it seemed that both included that specific function, as well as a variety of other features. We settled on the OpenWRT for the reasons that I've listed up there. Interestingly, it includes a package management system. So I think, for example, Kevin added an NTP server to his, so you could download a package and stick it on the router and run it. And then finally, I was quite taken with the name, so I thought it was appropriate for a project, Kamikaze, Backfire. That appealed to me. If you remember it was about a year ago, I mentioned its server naming, and I liked a few people that suggested some classics were Hindenburg, Titanic. So this is sort of in the same vein. It fits in
our
project.
The whole crash and burn idea.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Crash and sink, whatever.
We can get started on the next section. How long do we have until the break? Because one thing I don't have is a clock.
8:40, 20 minutes, 17 minutes.
Okay. Well, we'll continue. We'll get a good ways into it. Sure, that would be helpful. Okay. Next, to Kevin.
Well, of course, we had the idea, and we purchased the equipment, and said, well, you know, we want to make sure that it runs, it does more or less what we want. Like, the whole idea is that it has to span a certain distance. And we measured the distance between our homes, and it's like, okay, well, it turns out from the router, sorry, the antenna mounting points that we had considered, it was 72 meters. So we thought, well, it should work on that distance. They're directional antennas. But how is the best way to test this? Well, to test out the proof of concept, we thought, well, what's the biggest flat area with no obstructions that we can find? And it turns out there's a nice lake in our area. So two of us went over here, and Kelly stayed over here, and we held up our antennas. There's our testing setup with the beverages, and there's a UPS and the router and some laptops and other equipment. There's the an antenna down on the ground there. And so this is one view of the testing range from one end.
Hilarious.
And down at the other end, I think, is the next picture. There is me holding the antenna up at great range, and it turns out that the distance in that previous slide, you don't actually have to switch back, but the distance from end to end on the other slide was 490 meters. So we figured if it works over 490 meters and we get any connection at all, that probably it'll work fine for us over 70 meters, seven times the distance.
And at that point, I was running the DDWRT firmware on one of the routers for the testing. It has some really nice graphical tools that'll show you, like, real-time bar graphs that'll indicate signal strength and interference and link speed and
signal noise ratio.
We were, like, I was standing there with the antenna over my head, and so was Kevin at the other end.
Singleton-geese ratio.
Sorry?
The singleton-geese ratio.
Yeah.
Not at that point in the year, but yeah.
Yeah. That was probably August-ish.
There's another stat, I think, that our interviewer team might have. It's LIFZ. It's Lake in Fresnel Zone. That's
funny. Moving right along. Okay. So then the provided you're done.
Oh, I can hurry. Wait a minute. Your turn? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Next, I want to speak a little bit in more detail about the antenna we selected from a company named Superpass. This is the SPFP G13. It's a 2.4 gigahertz directional antenna. We got in touch with the fellow. We looked at a couple of different sites on the web and got in touch with the fellow at Superpass and said, this is our approximate distances we're working with. We're looking for directional antennas. We're going to connect them to the 54GL, so we need the right kinds of connections. And this was the one he recommended. Yes?
What's the geometrical layout of the three houses involved?
Well, you'll see that.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Don't get ahead of the presentation.
It's a good question.
Just went on what you said.
Yeah, I mean, I think we compared two or three models, and what the suggestions we got were all very similar, like the signal strength and the shape of the signal. And
that particular site, I think, has, in that category, has up to, I think, 20 dBi gain. But for the extra price, we just thought, yeah, that's probably half a medium.
What was the transmit power of the device?
I'll get into all that in just a minute. And just for your sake here, these antennas, the purchase price of these ones, they're US $35.
Wow.
We bought four of them, so it's $140. And then we needed four 10-foot cables to connect them from the antennas to the routers. And the cables were $13 each. But so the grand total Canadian was $230, which is about $57.52 per antenna.
That's pretty good.
They're weatherproof antennas, obviously made to be set up outside, and the lifetime rating on them is 20 years on these ones. So plenty long for what we're using for.
By the way, a lot of wireless ISPs have tried super fast antenna, and the weatherproof is quote-unquote. They just have glue in back that separates after a few years.
Yeah. They actually list it as weather-resistant, I think.
Water-resistant watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this gives you some sense of the the signal shape in this case.
Well, sort of maximum.
Yeah, max power.
Maximum power, but
yeah, like, I don't think they were aiming to microwave all the geese.
So it was. I mean, this is the first that I had looked at, you know, signal shape of antennas. But it was interesting to me that it's not just strictly
just
like
an ellipse or something.
Yeah,
or a
triangle
cone.
Straight out. It's a little more complicated than that. In fact, it sort of takes to my French, the Lee heritage actually. some of the specs, some more of the detailed specs on the antenna you're asking about, I'll run through them quickly. The frequency range was 2400 to 2483 megahertz. 50 ohms impedance.
Okay.
Sorry. Some of these things I have to say I don't even really know what they mean. So I'll pick out the ones that were significant to me. 13 dBi gain, vertical linear polarization, and as mentioned in the slide, 20 degrees horizontal beam width, 65 degrees vertical. The front to back ratio, which I assume
that's
means how much is leaking out the back, essentially, 21 dB, max power 20 watts, and then the connector is the N/SMA female, fed through the bottom of the antenna. The appearance, they call it a panel type. And then the size is about 11.5 inches wide by 4.5 inches, or 4.8 inches high, and about an inch deep. So it's about a foot.
Yeah,
that's a good size. Resume, my wife, it's about a foot. Anyways. The housing material of the thing is powder-coated aluminum, and the radom material is ABS with UV protection.
Yeah. That's the part that you actually see. It's just ABS plastic.
Yeah.
Yes?
So this is a passive antenna. There's no power to it?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and the most significant thing, obviously, is that it's a directional antenna, meaning that all of the majority of the signal is focused forwards directly away from the antenna. Okay. So in the next section, we'll look at some of the mounts that we designed to actually attach the antennas to our house. This first one is a design of Kevin's mount. Fortunately for us, Kevin had been working at the City of Winnipeg Assessment and Taxation Department and was able to get the actual exact measurements of distances between our house so we could use... to calculate the angle necessary to get the antenna pointed in the right direction. In this case, it's an 18 degree angle. That's correct. Eh?
Basic trigonometry to the rescue. So if you ever thought, oh, trig is never useful for anything, it's like, well, perfect application right here. We knew the distances, so we knew the opposite, the hypotenuse, and the adjacent angles, or rather lengths, and we knew it was a right angle, triangle, and so we just did it's a tangent, so tangent of the angle is equal to the opposite over the hypotenuse. And then I got my dad's friend, who's quite the woodworker, to help me design this, and I told him it had to be at 18 degrees, and so he cut everything for me and assembled it, and drilled all the holes, and I brought it home and painted it with some deck stain. There's a couple more pictures. So you might
what's the 18 degrees? This way or actually that?
18 degrees.
The elevation we didn't worry about because the beam angle is quite broad vertically.
Oh. There's your answer.
They actually are. Mine is, well, you'll see where mine is mounted and where his is mounted, and they're not that much different altitude-wise. So the angle is just sort of
just
in the horizontal plane. So that's what it looks like mounted. And you can see I put a bit of... screening over the ends because I didn't want anything nesting in there like wasps or birds or who knows what, so I put some screen over and then screwed the thing in the top. There you go.
I think you should put the screen right over the antenna.
What's that? So there's the antenna up there with the cable attached and then sort of looped a bit of the excess over the downspout, and then we drilled a hole through the frame of my window, which is all wood, and fed the the smaller end of the cable through there and did put some caulking in.
I think to fit the end that plugged into the antenna was larger than the end that plugs into the router, the different ends.
It's kind of annoying in that the cable itself, we didn't bring a sample because they're all in use. The cable itself is quite narrow, but the ends on it are quite big, and so you had to drill the hole for that because we had no assurance whatsoever that we could take the end off, feed the cable through, and then put the end back on properly. I'm sure it wouldn't work. So we just said, we'll just drill a big hole and put some around.
Is the cable actually different than coax? Is it a different type of cable than just regular coax?
Yes.
Yeah, a little different.
It's closer in diameter to, like, was it thin net? Is that the, you know?
Yeah, that's our
RG-62? 58?
TV coax is 75 ohm, this cable is 50 ohm. And you can get it in every size from that to, like, huge.
It doesn't matter because the DNC connector at the router is not a NP match connector, so.
But the cable, well, the cable needs to be matched.
It should be.
No, it's not a
50
ohm connector. It's a
10 ohm. Actually, it's the size of the. I know M connector. You can get different sizes.
The M connector is an impedance match connector. The BNC is not.
It's not BNC on a 54GL. It's SMA.
I think it's TNC on those.
Maybe.
I think it's RPTNC.
SMA would be a real little connector.
Yeah, SMA is like 4 millimeters.
Yeah, there is several options for connectors.
I mean, that's maybe, yeah. So maybe the specs I got from the site were not the ones we ended up with.
That's probably.
You can get the antenna in both M or SME, but those are M connectors on the.
Yeah.
On okay. Antennas. Okay. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
That's why I said N slash SMA.
Both available.
Is this not yours?
So that's where I ended up mounting it, and don't do this at home.
Yeah. So
I have to stand. You see what it says here? That's there. I had to stand on that to get my drill up, to this level. And
was anyone standing by the ladder while you were standing?
Rebecca.
Yeah, my 4-year-old daughter. Kelly could see me from his yard, I think, at that time. I can't remember.
Yelling, Rebecca, stand still!
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Anyway, I should have gotten a better ladder, I'm sure. Anyway.
Yes.
So that's another view of the thing actually mounted, so that's what it looks like from this angle. So that's the 18 degrees. Actually, it looks like a lot more. It looks almost like 45 or something.
It does.
No.
But it's, we measured it, like, several times. I'm sure it's 18 degrees.
Yep. Okay. Then moving along, here's the somewhat less scientific antenna mount over at my place.
Roughly 18 degrees.
Yeah.
But adjustable.
But adjustable, indeed.
But adjustable.
Yeah.
And 90 degrees.
I'm in the center, so I've got two, one pointed back towards Kevin, and we'll give you a sense of what
this one's
what
back pointed
like.
To me.
And then the other one pointed along the side of my house to my neighbor across the way that you'll see. And, mine is largely a couple of pipe clamps in there and then some boards sort of eyeballed to get the angles right. The benefit, of course, though, is that, the pipe clamps actually hold it on quite snugly. It's been up there for a couple of years. Even through the strong wind, it doesn't budge. And it is, flexible in the sense that you can arrange it to fine-tune.
Did you check with the laser?
No.
With the laser at night? To see if it's...
We could have. Yeah. Yeah. No, but we didn't.
We figured we had enough slack in the whole design. It wasn't really going to be an issue. Pretty close.
Yeah. And I was going to mention, too, on the drilling that we did, I think the depth through the window frames was, was about 8 inches, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Both of our houses are constructed with 2x6 walls. So that plus the inner and outer stuff was at least 8 inches. So.
I talked to a carpenter friend of mine about whether it would be better to go through the stucco and then, through the side of the wall like that. He said in that case you're more likely to break the vapor barrier, plus drilling through the stucco, you'll tend to crack it and it's harder to repair. So in my case, you'll notice there's the window immediately to the right there is quite new, actually. That window had been broken, but the window that the antenna goes through right next door is one of the old ones. So I drilled that one out for the time being. When it comes to changes, then we'll go. But so what we did to fill the holes was we just used the expandable foam insulation that you can spray in to fill the hole inside of it, and then caulking on the outside exterior caulking. It's quite good. I've checked quite carefully in the dead of winter, and no cold air gets in through there. So good.
What is that?
Additionally, in this picture, you can see along the back of the router there that we added...
Back of the antenna, not the router.
Sorry, yeah, we added in some caulking to help the seal last a little bit longer. The aluminum plate on the back, the ABS plastic sort of, the lip comes over the side, but it's just glued on the back of it, so it wouldn't last all that long. Finally, the third neighbor, Wes, is placed. His antenna installed directly above his garage door. So
his was the easiest.
Yeah.
By far.
Flat and screwed right on there.
No duct tape.
See, I told you we should have put that in. in Wes's case, his router is also installed in the garage. I'll show you some of that.
Is there anyone here who has not seen one of these WRT54G type routers up close? You're all okay with that? I've got one here if you want me to hand it around, but it's pretty straightforward. It's the kind that you've seen before, and the antennas come off quite easily.
Yeah, so let's see the connector. Oh, all right, that is TNC, isn't it?
So.
TNC.
Nothing too exciting about that. Okay.
So does your thing just plug into one of those antenna outputs?
Yes. This on Wes's house, the cable goes in there, through and around, and plugs into one of the things. Oops, one of the... there's where it comes in, and plugs into one of the connectors on the back of the router, and the other one has no antenna.
There seems to be something missing from this photo.
Well,
it's there on the desk. What do you want?
It was so.
Well, Wes is on vacation, so no.
So
did you plug nothing into the other port? Didn't you have to plug in a termination?
No.
Nope.
Didn't seem to care?
Nope.
No, handles it in firmware. Or hardware, actually. Well, sorry.
If it doesn't like one, it just shuts it off?
It just ignores the junk coming in on it.
Okay.
Can't you also, different firmware, use both of them separately?
Yeah.
So you can actually study general omnidirectional, and then you could have just like a Wi-Fi to your house on the same network.
I think so.
Don't do it. So choosing this of which port to broadcast on, which is the issue for stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right.
It can only broadcast, the switch lets you just broadcast on one.
Certainly in some of the firmwares, I know the DDWRT had the option to set one antenna as send and one as receive, or turn one off and turn the other one on. And, in this case, with the OpenWRT, I don't think that we set that, did we? No.
The default automatic setting is.
Yeah. Anyway, so we'll look at some of the mounts here. The one that we built for Wes's place, just the board, there's a couple of L brackets right along the bottom there to support the router. You'll see it mounted in the next slide. And some screws sticking out of the board on either side to prevent it from shifting. And then is it a Velcro strap in the
it's
center?
A piece of Velcro.
Yeah. And the cables come around.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep, does the trick.
It's crude.
So
it's strapped in. There's a screw on either side holding it so it doesn't shift left, right, and that supports it, and this keeps it from tipping over.
Does make sense.
Cool.
There's the cable plug-in.
Yeah, and the routers are so light. I mean, they weigh practically nothing. Supporting them really is not a non-issue, you know. Okay, here's the mount at my place.
More Velcro.
In my case, I just used two Velcro straps screwed into the stud in the wall. And there's a bench that sits right in front of that, so it's not all exposed. And then for this picture, the cable is out, but I just stuff it under the baseboard there all the way up to the corner and It does stick out a little bit, but it's really not hardly noticeable in the house there. I was also going to mention, just going, if you don't mind, I'll go back one slide here. Actually, it takes a minute. In the router installation in the garage, obviously there's a bit of a concern in the winter of it freezing, but the garage is insulated, and we thought if it does seem that the router is freezing, we would just put some kind of a box over top of it, and it's likely that the router produces enough heat on its own to prevent it from ever freezing when it's enclosed. Even at that case, we probably even have to vent the top of the box a little bit.
Yeah, amazing what a difference a few watts can make in an enclosed space.
24/7.
Yeah.
Even at minus 40. Well, I mean, the garage probably, near the ceiling of the garage, it probably wouldn't get more than like minus 10.
Except when the door's open. If you go to the thermal shock.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but again, heat rises.
Yeah.
So the door is below the router, so it wouldn't be that big a deal. Yeah, unless it's really windy, though.
I bet the door movie's going to stir up the air a bit, so you'll have a little bit of a cold dip.
Yeah.
So
it's still working.
Get the door closed.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
But it hasn't gone through a winter yet, so. We don't know.
And then,
what's the worst that could happen?
$30. $40 down the tube.
Yeah.
We've got a spare right here.
Yeah.
5-minute fade until the garage heats back up again.
Moving along.
And I was just for perspective's sake, I was also going to mention, you can see the one antenna right out the window there, so that's where they're mounted. I also wanted to have them there so they are, you know, they're easily accessible. I just open the window. And
is that like a second story or one
yes.
and a half?
Yes, it's a split. It's a split level house. Okay. Yeah, so one and a half really.
Okay,
my house is a bungalow.
Here's Kevin's router mount.
My mount.
Lean against the wall?
On top of a curtain rod.
Is that at 18 degrees?
Gravity stabilized installation. I like it.
Well, yeah. my rationale is that this bedroom, we moved into this house about 5 years ago. And this bedroom is one of the rooms that we haven't painted at all yet, and so I figured there's no point in putting a permanent mount on there and then having to paint around it or paint over it. I thought we'd do all that and then I'd, you know, get a nice box and, you know, color match it and everything. So I'm not in a big rush, but I'm going to put some conduit up and cover up all the wires.
We rated them. This one is the lowest, low SAF. Mine is mid SAF, and then Wes is in the garage. That's high SAF. The spousal approval factor. next up, Kevin's going to talk a little bit about the cabling you used.
Yeah, we had a box full or a lot of Cat5e cable, and it's gigabit rated, so I figured, oh, sure, it'll be good enough. Even though every single connection to these routers is fast Ethernet or 100 megabit. So we figured that was plenty good enough. The power supply, you think, well, how much of an issue could the power supply be? Well, if you remember, first of all, let me just sort of reiterate here that Kelly's house is the central house, so to speak, and he's on a split level, and the room that he's got his router and the antennas in is at some elevation. And in my house, which is a bungalow, it doesn't have something that's that high up. So I mounted it sort of around the eaves, and I didn't want the antenna the cable from the antenna to the router to be too long. So that meant that the router, when it was on the inside of my room, had to be fairly high up, which meant the power adapter wouldn't reach to the nearest outlet.
Yep.
So what do you do? Well, there's a number of options. You could use an extension cord, or you could get another adapter and sort of splice a length in and make it longer, or, you know, things like that. There's various things you could do. But I thought, you know, after doing a couple of quick Google searches and running across this one reference from, I think, a DDWRT site, it's like, you know what? You can power these over Ethernet.
But before we get into that, we're going to look at the cabling slide. Seeing as how they're next and it takes so long to move through it.
So this is where I had to run it. I had to figure out, I had to take the baseboard off because I wasn't sure. I wanted to run the cables in a conduit up between this casement window and the corner, which has a little bit of space. You can't really tell here. There's a few inches. And so I thought, well, where am I going to put it? So I take the baseboard off and figure, well, I have to drill fairly close to the corner. And there's the nearest outlet. And next slide. And so that's where I ended up putting the cables into. You can see it's quite close to the corner of my house. Next slide. And that's what I had to deal with. Do you know how annoying it is to try and get into that? This is a joist right here, a major joist.
Oh,
and that's the corner. And there's insulation there. So I had to pull the insulation out. And is there another slide? No, I don't think I included the other one.
Nope.
Anyway, so I did actually take that out, and I drilled in and took and realized that that's exactly where it went.
Where is that?
What?
What is that picture of?
This is my electrical panel.
This is your basement.
This is my basement looking up.
Yeah.
And that's where the cables come out through the floor and down.
Yeah.
And along here. So
this was all just to get the Ethernet cables from that room into the basement.
Yeah. From the router into the basement which is the room, well, it's my furnace room, where the laundry and all that, and that's where all my other cable plant goes to and where the backup servers were likely to be out of the way and all that sort of stuff. And so it's like, well, I guess I have to suck it up and do it. So yeah, the cables run a little bit along sort of the ceiling along there and then down to where I got all the other stuff. So it was quite a challenge. And I figured, okay, well, if I'm running one wire, I might as well run as many as possible. So, next slide. This is the one piece of conduit we ended up using. Got that at Nedco, which is on Route 90.
Bandwidth?
Near Dublin, I think, or somewhere there. It's like $6 a foot. It's ridiculous, but it looks really nice. It's got a piece of glue that's sticky stuff on the back. And three of these cables barely fit inside. It's a bit tight, but it's not too bad. But I figured if you're going to do it, you might as well do it all. So since there's four LAN ports on the back of these things, I figured let's populate all of them. Next slide. The reason for the funny angle is because this is actually the wall looking down, and this stuff here is some stuff that had been propped up against that. Because by the time I wanted to take the picture, he'd already put all the stuff. This is in his garage. Wes's garage, so you put all the stuff back, leaning back against the wall, and so I had to sort of stick the camera down and take a picture. So basically, this is a conduit down the wall, the wires go in through here, and you put a piece of wood on either side of it to protect the entrance into his house. Again, he's in a split level, and this goes into his basement and runs along the joists and into his other area where he's got the servers and stuff. So that's why it looks kind of funny. So there's the top end of the conduit, and we were going to run along here, but then we realized there's a power cable right there, AC power, and we didn't want to run this parallel to and immediately adjacent to that, so we went out one joist and then along, and then looped it around, and then his rotor is like right about here. Next. So, this is how you get...
Very sensitive to...
Sorry?
You can run 10 base T alongside power, so it's not a problem.
Really? Usually.
I wasn't too sure about that.
I'd be more concerned about high power transfer rather than interference transfer.
Yeah.
Well,
you take a lightning hit in the neighborhood and it's going to find that really attractive, literally.
There's no
interference.
Interference-wise, no. Conduit, you know, have the 10 base T and the high voltage.
Well, I just thought the alternating current waveform would...
No, it's the balanced lines, you know, so that it's basically very insensitive to noise.
Okay.
It didn't cost anything.
No, it wasn't any more difficult, really.
No, it was all open.
So again, we want to fully populate everything, so I decided to, since 100 megabit only uses two pairs and it's four pair wire, is split it and... Adam's making faces.
That's cool.
Well, it ain't gigabit rated now.
Well, no. Well, that's just it. It never will be.
Terminate.
That was never the intention.
Yeah.
You're talking wireless, you know.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's only going to be two megabytes, or about, it ends up being about 16 megabits. So.
Yeah.
I hope you labeled all the plugs well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is how you inject power over Ethernet.
Yeah.
So this is the signal cable, the green and orange wires. And you twist the other two pairs together after stripping them. And you solder in
Yep.
And voila, power over Ethernet. Okay, technically.
Is that right? That you just plug it into the back of the router?
Yeah, that actually. Yep.
No.
Well,
no.
So it's not a power over
Ethernet. I'll get to that.
Okay, you got another adapter.
There's more stuff going on here. Anyway.
Just split it back out.
Anyway, this you may notice is not a standard Linksys adapter. Also, you might wonder, well, how long can you make this? I mean, obviously, you just get this much wire normally, so how long can you make this before it's a problem? Well, let me just say that there is some loss the longer you make this cable, but the original adapter is 12 volts at 1 amp, and some people have done tests, and you lose a few volts over 300 feet of doing this. And the Linksys router should work, or has been found to work, on as little as 5.5 volts. So a few volts here and there isn't going to be a big deal. The only question I had was that this adapter, in contrast to the Linksys one, is 600 milliamps instead of 1 amp. But again, I thought, I can take a chance. It should be okay. So I tried it, and it works. Moving along. Oops. So, yeah, for the price, we're not going to worry too much. So, mods. You had to do a mod. So, this is where the WAN port comes in. Or, no, sorry. This is the power, where the power normally plugs in. This is the WAN port here. Pins 4 and 5 are the positive, and goes to the positive connector here of the power. And pins... 7 and 8, both are used to go to the negative.
Why didn't you pull the wire back out and just put it back onto the connector?
You mean the
other end?
This is cool. Yeah.
This is the power of the other device now.
Well, because then I would have to splice another wire, which I didn't want to do. And plus, this is actually the more important thing. I was reluctant to, since this is the first time I've ever done this, I was reluctant to use the original Linksys adapter and screw it up and not have something that worked at all. So I used that other adapter, and the other adapter wouldn't plug into the Linksys. So I would have had to cut the end off this anyway, and I was like, yeah, I could have injected it and then pulled it back out again and done it that way, but I thought, this is kind of cool.
This is power over Ethernet, basically.
It's not technically power over Ethernet.
Right.
It's literally power over Ethernet, but I think... the spec for power over Ethernet says it's 48 volts is what it has to provide, and this is like 9.
There's also a negotiation protocol.
Well, why is it like that transformer that you have there? That's what's supplying the power over Ethernet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Power over Ethernet is being supplied. You're injecting it.
I'm injecting it. It's not coming from my switch.
Function wires.
Okay.
Anyway. It's running. What's the problem here?
So it's kind of nice being able to have the adapter for as far away as you want. So just a few more pictures here. I put in a fuse, just in case.
Wise.
Fancy.
And here it is, working.
Pointless.
It's alive! And it's only plugged into the WAN port, and you see there's no power going to it.
Okay, that's cool.
Do you just want to remove the power jack and just...
And here's, again, the fully populated WAN port, all four LAN ports, and the cable, and that's in Wes's garage.
Yeah,
okay. Ta-da, we're done. Well, not the presentation, but... And now Kelly will tell you.
Yeah, so I'll explain a little bit more detail about the firmware. Just for interest's sake, I looked up on Wikipedia a couple of definitions, and the first one I'll paraphrase. They list what firmware is as being... small programs and or data structures that internally control various electronic devices, which enable the device's basic operation as well as implementing some of the higher level functions, which really is just saying a fancy way of saying, you know, it's the software that allows the device to be controlled. As far as why we replace it, I mentioned that already. The stock Linksys firmware that's included with the router doesn't provide the ability to use a router as a client to an existing wireless network. And finally, the interesting bit of networking that occurs is the wireless bridge, which we'll get into the diagram in a little bit to explain where that is. The wireless bridging is occurring at the center router, where the two, essentially where all the networks are connected together. But I'll touch on that in a little bit. Wikipedia, the definition there that I found for wireless bridging or bridging in networking is: a bridge is a hardware or software component which is used to connect two or more network segments which are physically or logically separate. So in our case, it's connecting wired networks to wireless, allowing the traffic all the way through. Applying the firmware to the router is really quite simple. All the routers have built-in web GUIs that allow you to use to update them to the current version. In the case of the GL, you just go to the firmware upgrade page, point it at the OpenWRT firmware file that you've downloaded, and run the upgrade. With some of the DDWRT firmware, I noticed, the flashing of the router is a two-step process, even though Linksys does essentially allow the use of third-party firmware. There's a 3 megabyte limit, 3 megabyte limit on the initial flash. So when we're using the DDWRT firmware, you first have to flash with the mini version, they call it, and then you can upload whatever firmware you want after that. So now we're going to get into a little bit of the overview of the wireless network. So Kevin's place is down at the bottom. You can see that that's approximately where the antenna is mounted. My place in the center, and Wes's place across the street. I pulled this map out of Google Earth. The approximate distances between our houses are, from Kevin's to my place, is about 72 meters. And then from my place to Wes's, about 45. And you remember in our initial test across the lake, it was way, way farther. So we, you know, were optimistic we would get good results.
But for one problem.
Here is looking from Kevin's backyard to my place. What you see there is the antenna mounted outside my window. So there's very nearly line of sight. This is actually a couple of feet into the backyard from the antenna. So the antennas are obscured. The direct path has trees in the way.
nothing a little Agent Orange wouldn't fix.
We talked about running a Cat 5 cable along the top of the fences in the middle of the night, but thought it was not likely sustainable.
Less weatherproof.
So here's the view out the window from my place back to Kevin's.
It's a bit tight.
Opposite direction. In this case, his router is obscured. The arrow sort of points as nearly to where it's physically located as possible. And then also from out my window across the street to west, it's a clear path in that case. So that one's easy. Good
line
sight.
Did you say that's 40 meters?
45. According to Google Earth.
Well, it's across the street and everything. It's a lot more shortened in this view.
Yeah.
They're
big lots.
That's the width of the street, the length of the driveway.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
And then here's the other perspective. My back is against his garage below the antenna, looking back.
I see.
Yeah, so the antenna is, it's unfortunately in in this application, the arrows would lock. You couldn't drag them bit by bit.
Grid going
yeah.
On.
So it's not exactly. Yeah,
it's not exactly right there.
No.
So it's Wes's close. House and Kelly and oh, that's to Kelly's house. Sorry, never mind. I thought Wes to Kevin's. I'm like, but I.
Yep.
Forget it.
So then the next, this was the fun part for me, was coming up with our network diagram, how we'd set it up. This is our working copy. We'll look at the actual nicely printed out one over here, and I'll explain what's going on. So the existing networks, of course, are private. This is thanks to the slaughter at Kevin's work. the existing networks are private networks with the LAN we already have. Like we already have a system router or a consumer router at home. So Kevin over here at 27. This is my private LAN here at 22. And then Wes is at 1. In each of the private networks, there is our regular router and the firewall that takes us out to the web. So mine up private here.
Evil dark internet cloud.
Yeah, Kevin's here, and then Brian here, and Wes out this way.
Did you have to re-ID before you hooked everybody up?
No.
Oh, okay.
You just got lucky.
No, we just wrote it down.
No, it was lucky that you didn't happen to have
already do it. Oh, yeah. Well, see, I mean, it's the slacker, right?
Default. Mr. Default.
Does your house number happen to be number 27 on your street?
Well, Kevin, that would be a good guess. Two is my favorite number.
Okay.
So then the wireless routers exist at this point. Kevin's here. Ryan here. And Wes is here. What you'll notice that's interesting is there's an additional router right here. This is the one that's connected to the two antennas at my place. So there's only one here, but there is one facing this way to Kevin's house and one facing this way to Wes's house.
Do you have two routers driving the two antennas?
No.
One router,
yeah. So in this case, there's a single antenna plugged in at Kevin's place. And at Wes's place, a single antenna plugged in. And then in the center at my place, two antennas.
So you've got the classic dude on 11 hidden client problem.
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking.
Okay, never mind.
Okay, but maybe we'll answer it as we move along.
You mean two clients that can't see each other?
Yeah.
Well,
so they wind up talking over each other.
Yeah, we haven't really run into too much trouble yet. But
it might not be a problem because of directionals. I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah, because
they don't really talk over each other, do they?
Well,
it's if the router in the middle wants to receive and both of them try to transmit at the same time, then you have the problem.
But I don't know if that Broadcom chip can receive two packets simultaneously from two antennas.
No.
That's not that good?
No.
Okay. Well,
it has a transmit-receive switch.
So we do have a spare router. We can fix that.
Yeah.
Actually, that would boost the speed from your place to Wes's place dramatically.
In this case, these two routers, the wireless router at Kevin's and Wes's place, are running the open WRT firmware, and then this router is just the stock basis firmware. The open WRT supports this configuration with WPA2 setup, so it is encrypted between all of the networks. And then at Kevin and Wes's place, what they decided to do ultimately was, this is the gateway for all of the machines, right? So whenever they've got a client that's asking for something outside of the network, yeah, you could put, routes into every client in your network. That's a pain to maintain. But what they said is they added routing entries on this router to say, if you're looking for 254, head out to 253. So they go from clients will go here to get out, and it tells them this is way out, and pulls them to this network. And then the opposite is true on this end. For Wes, this is his default gateway out to the web, and it's just got a route to say,
The way out to 254 is through 252. It's through 1.2 here. In my case, in the central network, I did a little bit differently. Hopefully I'm not losing you. Feel free to ask a question. It's a lot. A lot of us sink in. But in my case, this router is strictly acting as a bridge. The wireless connections and the Ethernet cable that connects it back to my private network are all in the LAN. So there's nothing connected to the LAN port, so this whole thing is just a big, it's all in the same LAN, same network. This is all 254, and then from my end, I only have a single router, in that when my hosts want out, they go to this router, they go out to the web, and they say, if you want to get into the 254 network, this router has an interface on that network. All right. So all that this router is doing is allowing for these two wireless routers to connect and set up the big wireless network. Everybody follow that, more or less?
There will be a bit more additional explanation after that.
Yeah, when we actually talk about what goes where, we'll say how this works.
Distributions.
So then, in addition to our private LANs, which are here, here, and here, and the wireless network, okay, the wireless network is 254, we also added these secondary networks. And, you know, I had mentioned that I had a backup box at Kevin's place, he had one at Wes's place, and, you know, he was off-site. This is where those backup boxes would be stored. What that allows for is Wes can have Kevin's box here at his place, but it's not in his house. It's still routable via the wireless. So he'll park his backup machine here in 252 and can get at it across the wireless link without going into Wes's private.
So even if you employ a switch flooding attack, you still can't see what porn each other's looking at, right?
Okay. It's not like you're speaking from experience. Anyways, and likewise, obviously, back over here, this is the secondary network. So if when I put my backup box over at Kevin's place, this is where it goes, in 253. So I can get at it through the wireless network, and it's outside of Kevin's private network. In the case of the central network, Kevin's going to have a backup box here, but because of the router acting only as a bridge, we're going to put his backup host right here in this network. So it's actually in the same network as all of the wires. But again, outside my private LAN and accessible via the wireless network. Finally, we're going to put in, you know, I mentioned the shared media box. This is where it's going to go down. So it's accessible for all of us.
Is it discoverable?
Sure.
Distribution centers usually have to discover, and they discover by broadcast.
Yeah.
So unless you do some work here, go old school and do proxy ARP or something, you're not going to make it. It's not going to be discoverable.
You wouldn't want broadcast traveling
across a hidden client LAN anyway.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want it, no, but otherwise there's no discoverability.
Which is good. Just treat it like a torrent site.
But who's got the directory server then? I mean, if you put it in the tables, I guess, you'd make it appear discoverable in the three LANs. With a little bit of table entries in the three routers.
Yeah, and the way we have it set up right now is, I mean, any host from inside essentially
any of the networks can see everything in this area, right? Hosts in each of the LANs can see this and these two networks as well, the secondary networks where the backup machine will go.
Yeah, this network here and this and the other one over here are this and this and this are all not firewalled from each other, so we just have static routes that are set up so that everything can see everything in here.
Yeah, they're seeing the one there's discovering because the broadcast packets aren't going to go.
No, we don't want broadcast packets to go there.
So then you have to go into distribution client and put the address in directly.
Yeah. Do you know what he's talking about? I don't.
I don't know. In my case,
I run it.
We're using routing. We're not using broadcasts or discovering. Or
for the sharing of media that you wish to interchange among yourselves, what kind of a sharing?
And there's no discovery needed.
Yeah, that answers the question.
Yeah. And the machine that we'll be using is the central media machine, you know, it's fixed IP address.
It's going to be one
tracking file.
Pretty much.
Beg your pardon?
There's no streaming.
Yes.
Well, why would you stream an Ubuntu DVD? You know, come on.
Why not? I want you installed.
Did you bother playing with fixed channels, or did you let them stay dynamic? Channel 6, you just leave it.
You mean which wireless channel?
Yeah, correct.
We just picked one. We did a survey of the neighborhood and picked one that was less used.
And then stuck with one, or used mono?
Well, stuck with one for this.
Just
like,
the
for
one.
For example, in my case, well, I think in all of our cases, these routers here, you know, the routers protecting our private networks are also wireless routers.
Yeah.
So I ended up, you know, we specified the channel for this one, and I specified the channel for mine as well. Because it does cause some of that and the baby monitors and everything else in the house. But yeah, I think we used, I don't recall if we used 1 or 11 for this one.
One of the benefits, I think, not that I've actually tried this, but my understanding is that with OpenWRT, you can actually select channel 14.
I'll just point out.
Only in Japan.
Yeah. Hmm?
It's only legal in Japan.
And Europe, I thought.
Maybe
parts of Europe.
It was not in Canada.
I doubt the frequency police are going to come down on us. So.
Yeah, you know, I'd be more worried there's something in there, which is why they're not legal here. What's in that band here?
Medical equipment.
ISM band. Huh?
But you guys know, if you want to get away from interference, you just need to turn the antenna 90 degrees to get horizontal polarization, because most of the interference is vertical polarization. So if you turn the antennas to horizontal, you'll be 20 dBs more away from any interference.
The actual orientation of the mast, like the rubber band, or in this case, would be the length, would be the axis. And rather than tall, you go this way?
You just turn 90 degrees.
But you have to turn all the antennas.
Yeah,
exactly.
Are barely polarizing when you get that good effect.
Yeah.
These antennas they're using, they probably would.
They
got a much
most,
more distinct.
Most of those are 20 dB cross pole. So that would get you a good bit away from interference if you just turned them 90 degrees.
The only problem is, of course, now you got a bandwidth that's this wide in the horizontal plane, which is not what you want.
Yeah.
let's see here.
But they're using it like just
nice.
Single second.
Wouldn't be a problem.
You guys have got so much.
Yeah, it would. Because it's gone through all the calculation this way, which is easy to do.
But
he's got three different height houses, and now you've got a real narrow beamwidth in the horizontal.
That's not narrow. 18 degrees, you could do it blindfolded.
Well, yeah.
Same, one's 20, one's 18, one's 20.
But if you guys want a lot of speed instead of this, 2.4 has some interference. If you have line of sight, or you can get line of sight with a tree cutter, I would. 2.8 actually has a little bit of interference in Winnipeg, because a number of organizations have 5.8 backhauls. And Terrigo and I think it's Wideband. They're using 5.8 as well. 5.2, no one's using because it's short distance. Mm. But you could buy like one of those Ubiquiti radios that do N with up to 300 megabits, and you don't need to deal with antennas or coax. They're power over Ethernet, so just stick it outside, run a Cat5 inside, run a power adapter.
Mm-hmm.
and set it to 5.2. So then you have, you could probably do the whole like 300 megabit end frequency between the sites.
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be a lot faster and you'd have no interference.
Well, in 3 years, we'll get on to it. Yeah. Wireless neighborhood 2.0. So any questions about the diagram there?
Okay. That's more routers than the four that you told us in the
Well,
it's like they 6 to me, but
that's okay. No, but it's only three that's used for the...
Three new ones.
Net, yeah.
The three
the other ones are just in-house. So.
Yeah, three additional and four antennas. But acting as a bridge.
Okay. Can I ask Kevin a question? Was that little Unix PC that you had in your part of that project?
Well, the no, Shiba? Not strictly, but
okay.
It's going to be my backup box.
Okay. Power spot.
Yeah, the Shiba plug.
Well,
I think you all pretty much know what this is all about. So.
Yep. Quick look at the back end of the router there.
Is there any issues with sending packets from the wired network to the wireless? Like, I heard that some of the BIOSes will route from wireless to the wired network, but they won't go the other way, and they're built that way?
There's no option.
Option?
Yeah. Stock in a lot of these. There's no option to say.
I've had trouble with that on mine.
Yeah. Not that I've heard.
But it might be a setting that
check
I just don't know
around
what
it's around.
I mean, in the case of the center router that's connecting the two outside ones, it's just as if there were, you know, two laptops connected to it. They're in the same wireless LAN, and they
yeah,
can see each other.
But from your house, like your internal network in your house.
You mean here?
Going. So, yeah, I'm down on your side.
Like here? Or?
No, over to the left. Inside your house.
From here.
What's that?
That's inside my house.
Yeah, and so your like, PC's on your...
It's
on
in
your internet,
it's in here.
House, yes.
Yeah.
Going out.
Going to here?
Yeah.
Or down here?
No, down here. Where? Yeah, going out that way.
Going out here? That's just my cable modem here.
Yeah. Now go. But, go oh. out yeah. toward your shared network.
Yeah, that's the shared network here. But that's just a router. Network. It's just routing stuff from here to here, and it has a static route that says if you need to get to this network, you just route it to here, and then this thing. Takes, you know, because it's wired from here to here.
Yeah, okay.
And then this is connected to the wireless antenna, so it just handles that.
No problem.
Just zero problem.
The vast majority of home routers put the wired and they actually bridge the wired and wireless.
Yeah that's what's happening here.
LANs together transparently for you.
Yeah.
There have been a very small number of models over the years who have decided to do it more securely and have wired go to WAN. And wireless go to WAN, but not have wired and wireless talk to each other.
Yeah.
So that's
partitioning.
Yeah, well, that's why this router here has three addresses. It has one on my internal network, 27.2. Yeah. It has one on the wireless, which is 254.1, and it has a third interface on 253.1, which is all the stuff that's in here.
Yep.
So it's got three interfaces.
And
it routes between them. It doesn't bridge. It just routes.
But you can do that because you run the OpenWRT.
You
run the open source software on it.
Yeah, that's how I can do it so easily.
I
don't know how I'd do it any other way.
You have a stock router now. You just make that the DMZ.
The problem is that this is the LAN, which normally is shared with this, bridge to this.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of reversed it because the WAN port is actually protected against the internal stuff versus, mm-hmm. you know, these things being protected against here. So it's kind of I had to reverse the sense of the normal WAN and LAN areas. John?
I don't know if this will clarify for you, Steve, but some of the writers, as Adam was just clearing up here a minute ago, is... Wireless and wired inside these routers don't necessarily talk to each other. And you're saying you have a problem sometimes where sometimes they do, sometimes they don't kind of stuff?
Well, I have... My daughter can print from her wireless PC to a printer that's connected to a PC, mm-hmm. wired PC. But if we move the printer onto a wireless PC. You can't print the other way.
That's probably something at another level, I think.
Maybe a firewall.
Yeah, I think so. Firewall on the PC is what it sounds like.
Anyway, let's carry on.
Okay. So kind of touching on that, this is sort of the diagram of logically how the router sees all of its connected ports. And so all of the bridging and the routing, this was news to me, so maybe it was obvious to everyone else, but it's implemented in the CPU. All the ports are just connected. And then the way that the router makes the distinction between what networks essentially should be allowed to talk to each other is through the VLAN tagging, which is basically just a logical way of assigning all of these ports and the wireless into networks. So by default, VLAN 0 are the four switch ports and the wireless network.
Also called VR0.
Yeah, called VR0. It's taking wired connections and the wireless connection and saying you guys are all in the same VLAN. Your traffic is visible to all the hosts in that VLAN. And then it takes the VLAN 1 and it's assigning that to the WAN port, which is here, which is your internet connection, and saying keep the traffic separated. With the third-party firmware, what it allows you to do, essentially, is take this or any of these ports and assign them into VLANs however you want. So you could have, you know, two ports in a VLAN, the wireless in a separate VLAN, the internet in a separate VLAN, and basically, using the routing rules in the router, you can route between those VLANs, but the traffic isn't visible across one to the other. This was handy in our case because, as Kevin mentioned, he sort of switched around the way he was using the WAN port. But basically it means the designations WAN port and wireless are irrelevant. It's just a bunch of ports and you can group them together however you want. So with the third-party firmware, you can change which ports are assigned to which VLANs, and you can add more VLANs if you want to. In my router in my private LAN, which is this one here.
I think that one?
Yeah. That's a wireless router. So what I've done in this case is the wireless connection and one of the switch ports are in a VLAN, one single network together. That's 22.0, and that's where all my hosts go. They have access to the internet through the WAN port, and then the remaining three switch ports are separated into a separate, like a DMZ network. Instead of in the stock firmware, it allows for just, you know, using one port, but you can assign them separately that way if you want to. And it also would allow you to have your wireless be in a separate VLAN and all of your switch ports in a single, so you could offer public wireless and no access into your LAN. Okay. Then the next step is the actual config files in the router.
Well, I'm going to try and zip through this because it doesn't really need that much. Well, it would need a lot of explanation if I wanted every one of you to understand it completely, but that's not really the goal here. It's just to give you an idea of what we had to do to set it up the way we wanted. So, as it turns out, there's really three files that you end up having to spend the most attention on. Wireless here is fairly simple. It's just to make sure that you configured the right channel and the PSK, the pre-shared key, and other things like that. So basic configuration security. Network tells you all the addresses of the various, like here, for example, I use that to set up the three interfaces and what their IP addresses are, and the topology, so in different subnets. And lastly, the other file would be, I think, etc config firewall, but the OpenWRT firewall configuration file
I found to have a really verbose and awkward syntax. And because it was so unfamiliar to me, and because it does, it has a system that translates the etc config firewall from its format into IP tables commands anyway, I said, and because due to the weird syntax of this file, I couldn't figure out how to do this. I looked at it and I stared at it and I tried a bunch of things and it's like, I really don't understand how to use this syntax to set up something that I'm pretty sure would be pretty straightforward in IP tables. So what I did, what you can do is you issue a couple of commands, basically etc init d firewall stop and then firewall disable. And then I just put a whole bunch of IP tables rules into etc rc local. And it works. So, moving on. Again, you just there's a section here that tells you that it's going to be called, this device is going to be called WL0. It's a Broadcom. It's not disabled. I'm using channel 11. And then it goes on for the actual interface. You can set the SSID. STA means it's a client. It's going to be called the Wi-Fi network in later files. I'm using PSK2 encryption, and there's our secret password. Not. Okay, so here's the VLAN stuff where you can set up which VLANs. The number 5, again, is the CPU port. So if you set up a VLAN that doesn't have port 5 in its list, it won't be rootable by the CPU because the CPU won't even see it. There's the loopback, which is pretty straightforward, statically set to the standard thing. And then there's my LAN, which I decided would be called this. The LAN corresponds to this DMZ area over here, 253.0, and I've assigned it to 253.1 is the interface address. And next... the WAN port, I just left it called WAN because that's what it's labeled on the back of the box, so I thought I'd just keep the name fairly understandable. That's my internal address that I use for that, and there's the gateway is actually out to the internet through there. This is the default route. Not quite sure what that is. Somebody else can explain it later. I don't want to go into it. So. And I just manually set a couple of DNS servers. That's the SHA ones. And lastly, the wireless LAN is set to 254.1, which is right there. So that's how I set mine up. Wes's setup over here, as you can see by this diagram, is an exact mirror of mine with just the addresses changed. So there's absolutely no difference there between his and mine except the addresses. And this is how I set the static routes. So this is from my network's perspective. If something is trying to reach the 22.0 network, which is Kelly's internal private network here, the way to get there is to forward stuff to 254.65, which is this router right here. And that means this one can talk directly to... Because this... It's a little funky here, because this interface .65 here is actually on the... in the DMZ here. It's not firewall off. I mean, technically it is, but it's visible. And again, if you want to get to 1.0, you go from here over to 254.254 is the gateway to get back to his 1.0. And to get to the DMZ on the other side of the wireless link, 252.0, you go to also to 254.254. So you go to here, and that forwards it down to this DMZ area here. So, that's pretty much it. The main use case that I was most concerned about is I considered various backup ideas, and just for basic off-site mirroring, if you just want to say, in case of a complete disaster, I just want the latest complete copy somewhere else, not in my house. In case my house burns to the ground, then you can just use a basic rsync and synchronize everything. You can get you can use all sorts of other stuff. There's many, many options. The other thing that you might want to consider if you actually want to have multiple versions, so not just for disaster recovery, but the, oh, I didn't mean to delete that variety,
You can use something like RDIP backup and use that to keep multiple versions, since I'll have over at the other site, my backup device will have a 1.5 terabyte disk, which is way more than I really need for my critical stuff. So I might as well keep a bunch of versions around, so I'll probably use RDIP backup for that purpose.
And then finally, the central media system. In this case, it's an old machine, but our demands on it are light. It's basically just a big storage machine. We just picked up a 2 terabyte hard drive from Computer Avenue for, I think, about $120.
Yep.
Stuck it in there, and it's going to be running Samba so that it's browsable from Windows clients. And I don't know yet if we need the rsyncd, but we can rsync files from that machine back. This machine is located in the wireless network, so that's in the 254, right in the center there. And we were, you know, considering the logistics of how would we be able to store all of our distros there and then sync them back to our own private network.
So he means install.
So the our process so far that we've come up with is whenever we have a new distro that we want to share, we're going to stick it on that central box. Everyone can write files to that box, and then we'll just sync the whole thing back into our private networks.
Because while the wireless link is reasonably fast, depending on what you're comparing it to, it's still better to have something local on your LAN if you need to have better access to it than rely on the fact that, you know, you're all sharing this 54G connection, which is not really anywhere near 54 megabits a second.
What speeds do you guys get?
Hmm?
What speeds do you get?
In early tests, we're getting about, well, data transfer-wise, about 14, 15 megabits a second. So we haven't really paid too much attention.
Actually, yeah, pretty good.
It's a lot faster than Shaw's upload.
Have you tested independently the speed between your house and Wes's house versus either of your houses and Kelly's house?
Actually, no.
Not yet.
That could be a bit slow, you know, going through the router.
It could be an issue.
Most everything's going to Kelly's house, right?
Yeah, well, not everything will, though. So.
Yeah.
We'd like to be able to put like a game server or something maybe here and then go over to Wes's house. And, you know, so, we'll see. We'll do some tests. We'll find out. Nothing is final or written in stone. We can change it.
Stucco versus tree.
Is that?
Half your Fresnel.
Fresnel.
Zone is gone from your place to Wes's. And going between your places, there's a bunch of trees that are going to be different when they're wet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They might be better in winter.
Yeah, probably will, yeah.
Although, you know, 211 protocols are remarkably tolerant of intrusions into the Fresnel zone.
Good.
I mean, up to a certain critical threshold, obviously. But
I've done a little bit of testing from my LAN to my backup box, which is over the link through the trees, in you know, relatively severe weather, like quite windy when the branches are, and it hardly seems to make any difference.
No, that'll actually probably give you better throughput. Because the occlusion will be statistically less of the time.
Right.
Mm. I think this link is so short it doesn't really matter unless
probably.
You're trying to go through a building.
Yeah, I don't think
so. It's really raining hard.
Yeah.
No. It'd actually be like a waterfall.
Yeah, but those times when you couldn't see across the street, that probably.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Be brief, though.
Yeah. We did hear the transmit power, though, on the link.
Are you running a default transmit powers?
Yeah, currently.
That's 75 milliwatts.
Okay. And that brings us to the end of our presentation, unless you have some questions. Anyone have any questions? Yes?
When are you going to upgrade to N?
Sorry?
When are you going to upgrade to wireless N?
Oh. Next summer? I don't know.
I guess
if one of your internet connections goes down, can you share the other one? Does that just happen automatically? When
no. It's feasible, but no.
Yeah, it's possible. The routing isn't in place to do that yet, but.
You'd have to do IBGP to do that.
No, you just need
need fallback capability in one of the routers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, you're right.
I was going to suggest, if you guys haven't looked at it, just do equal cost multipath routing to the outside world. Because it is possible you can set preference really, really easy in Linux.
True.
Set preference to your home and then have others go in there. So if you're downloading distributions, it goes really fast.
The only catch would be the guy in the middle is using a stock box.
Yeah, we probably have to change
he's
that.
He's got no, well, I can't do that because most of the stock boxes don't do that.
Yeah, but your machine could do that. Like if you were running a Linux box as a client there using that on that network, you could because you could just specify the routes going that way.
Right.
That's true. That's layer 3, not layer 2.
Yeah.
Although, that wouldn't really speed up your
That would have to go through our private cellular router. So.
Yeah, that's hence the BitTorrent, where it actually makes a whole bunch of connections.
Yeah, you're right.
The other catches were all on SHA now, so...
If one goes, they all go.
but you're still bound because it's all coax, too, so you're bound by the cable modem in the area as opposed to MTS.
Yeah, well, plus, I mean, the other connections would be bound by the bandwidth here of the wireless, which is only about, which is not bad
to the outside world.
But it's not gonna, and like me, if I tried that, then I'd be getting two of them sharing the one link back to my place, so it would saturate pretty quick, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It would be better than just my own link by itself,
but not
I wouldn't triple my speed.
No, but it would see great performance.
Double at best. Mm-hmm. I think.
Well, that's assuming that you're like making three connections for the same byte of the file, right? It just,
So you're getting the satellite link?
Well, you've got MTS, you've got SHA, you've got TerraGo, you've got Y-band. And that's just the easily accessible providers. Actually, technically, if you include less... I mean, it's running over the same copper as MTS, but it's through a different back-end infrastructure.
But if the DSLAM goes, you're still screwed.
Well, but just, don't go very just before we go too far, like, the point was just to connect our house. It wasn't internet bandwidth.
A bit of downtime is not too serious.
Right.
Well done, Bill. Yeah.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more Mug Meeting summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website. You can find it at mug.mb.ca.